This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. It's a butter egg made from plants. Bring more customers in your doors with Just Egg. Start with a free sample at ju.st/hrn.
Opening soon is sponsored by DiageoBarAcademy.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we're talking organization. Not mise en place or keeping your knives in a row, but labor organizing.
If any restaurant worker is listening to this and is like, yes, I want something different, but I don't know where to start. First step they just need to do is to find one of us and get plugged in.
As independent contractors, they can't directly tell people, you know, when or where to work, but by using sort of gamified nudges to push people, that is sort of how they move the workforce around.
Tune in to Meet in Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
As you may well already know, our podcast focuses primarily on the business of opening restaurants. From ideation to opening day, we have aimed to talk with both the industry's best and the industry's newest to share wins and challenges that are associated with everything from funding to construction to hiring. Today, we've also chatted with vendors that assist in the opening, including legal experts, technology companies, and press relations, but never a hospitality consultant. Hired expert to come in and assist new or even seasoned entrepreneurs to chart, plan, and enact their vision.
So when our friend and longtime Tillit supporter came into the shop for some new threads for his latest consulting gig, we booked him on the spot. We're welcoming Bradford Thompson to the show today. His resume includes experience from being named Food and Wine's Best New Chef and a coveted James Beard Award. And he has helped open loads and loads of restaurants. So welcome to the show, Bradford.
Welcome.
Thank you, guys. It's great to be on. And I didn't know I was the first, so that's exciting.
You're the first consultant. Yeah, because a lot of times in the past we've talked to restaurateurs. We've had some like architects and designers and things like that and comms people. We've done PR episodes, but you're the first one who's like a consulting chef. So how many openings have you been a part of now?
So I'm up over 30 now. I kind of stopped counting.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I thought you were gonna be like 15, but I didn't realize you're in. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, 30. I'm in the 30s though.
And it's,
it kind of makes me feel old that I've done that many, but it's also, you know, I always like to say that it sounds so cliche, but there are no two that are even close to being the same. It's such an interesting thing that I get to do, and it's so stimulating creatively and mentally each time that it's really. Like, you know, they open, you go through and it's just like, wow, we're up to 30 now. And each one, I feel like I have so much more to learn. That's the kind of the great part about it.
That's, yeah, I'm sure there's a lot that you've learned over 30 openings. You mentioned that no two are the same, but is there any like common threads that you've seen? Okay, this is, we're going to get caught up on this at this time. Like tell us some of like the common hiccups that you've seen.
Yeah, there's definitely commonality, and there's definitely mistakes that you see people make, that especially inexperienced restaurateurs, but even the ones that have opened several restaurants, they'll kind of get in a rhythm where they like to do things. And that's kind of the danger is always like if you just sort of treat it like a routine, like, okay, we've already got four restaurants, we know what we're doing. You sort of take your eye off the details sometimes. So I think the first thing that anyone will tell you is people not having enough capital or allowing enough time to get open. That's something that, you know, there's never enough time and you're never exactly where you want to be. But budgeting for proper training and, you know, I was listening to your last guest, I think it was last week, from Chicago, and he was talking about taking a week with his sous chefs to do recipe testing. And I was so happy to hear that because so many people just sort of cram that into a day or kind of do it on the side. And to me, that's the kind of stuff that you don't get a chance to go back and do once you're open and really allowing for that time.
Yeah, I feel like you usually hear that they do it, that the chef is testing and doing those things the entire time that they're working. And then they hire everybody and the next day they're like training and working at the same time. It's definitely, I agree with you.
Yeah.
What, tell us, Bradford, like what, who is hiring you now and recently, and who should be hiring you? Is it seasoned people that are, you know, too busy to do it themselves? Is it people that, are trying to open without a chef partner and want to have somebody there to guide them on that end? What kind of person is coming to you?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it is all types of people are coming. The reason I started doing this, my last actual job, I was at Leverhaus and it was closed in a very sudden fashion. And I was actually cleaning out my desk and Terrence Brendan called. He had been a friend for a while. And said, "Hey, I just took over a new spot in Tribeca. Can you help me get open?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure. I'm not doing anything now. I'll come and help you." And it was within a week or two of doing that I realized how much I had accumulated besides cooking over the years of how to put a storeroom together and training staff and scheduling and all the little stuff that goes into doing a quick opening. And it kind of went from this in-between jobs mentality to that there's really a career here in this. There's a business here. And the way I pitch myself in the beginning is most people don't have a chef 6 or 9 months out, but they're making decisions that will affect the chef. So when they sit maybe with an architect and a designer and they design a beautiful kitchen and they pick equipment, and then the chef comes in and the hinges are on the wrong side of all the fridge doors, or they want to, you know, pull out drawers instead of swinging doors. Those little things make a big difference for a kitchen and how efficient it is. And so I kind of put myself in that, you don't have a chef, so I'm going to kind of think like a chef for you through this process. And then in addition, I have relationships with architects and designers and kitchen equipment supply, so that I can kind of leverage those relationships and take that out of an owner's hands. So, you know, the people that I work best with are somewhat experienced, that know the things they don't want to do, but they know what has to get done. And they can kind of give me, we need to get this kitchen built. I need it negotiated. I need equipment bids, all of that stuff. And really understand their vision for their menu and their concept so that we build a correct kitchen. And most importantly, we build something that's got flexibility built in. You know, I think that's the thing. People sort of get focused on their concept and they lose track of, you know, plan for success and what happens when we get really busy or we add takeout or we build that patio. Can we sustain ourselves or are we going to have to redesign the kitchen? So really thinking through and saying, what are we building for now? And then how can we add to this and how can we enhance it without spending a ton of money down the road? So that's my long answer to your question.
No, I mean, it's all good things that I think people don't necessarily think about. So what does a typical like consulting engagement look like for you? When do you typically start working with people? How long after open are you with them? What is, you know, or does it depend?
Yeah. Again, it's really, I wish there was a typical, but there isn't. There's, you know, typically my best work and my best situation is to get involved, you know, around the time they hire the architect, you know, like right after they sign the lease. Some people I've worked with them to look at spaces before they sign a lease, but ideally, you know, when they hire the architect, if I'm involved from that point, those discussions, because a lot of owners don't understand, you know, the building codes and don't need to, frankly, but if they're relying just on the architect to sort of guide their build process, their design process, and they don't have a chef or a food consultant involved, then they're kind of at the hands of the designer and the architect, and they'll get a beautiful looking space that may not be functional. So ideally I'm involved from that point. And then I like being in the construction meetings. And I, you know, I like understanding that process because it makes it better for me to understand where the money's going, where the budget's going, you know, looking at a space and watching it go from a dirty something else to a shell to starting to be built. You start to see the vision and you can correct things early enough, it doesn't cost you a ton of money. And then the second part of it is, you know, being with them from the beginning is really understanding what the concept is. And that's another area where people kind of tend to get lost, or they get really stuck and they can only be one thing, or they don't have a focus at all. And they're just kind of at the whim of the people around them saying, oh yeah, you should put avocado toast on the menu. And, you know, I have this really good dish. Look, here's an Instagram photo. Check this out. You should put this on the menu. And if they don't have that strong point of view, it's really easy to get washed up in that.
I know, that's how we had the great avocado toast expansion of the aughts. I mean, it's like literally it was just on every menu because everybody's like, we have to have avocado toast on the menu.
Yeah.
Where, so you mentioned common places where like you see money going and things, because most people are like, get me out of the construction phase. This is a shit show and a disaster. So it's kind of refreshing to hear somebody being like, I like construction. I like being there to help with the GC.
I walked to space this morning. I love it. To me, it's like if you go to the market and you get a, you know, you get a box of stuff from the market and you go back to your kitchen, it's like this endless possibility when you're in a space that's early in construction or just being put together, because you can still, you know, you go different times a day, you see what the light looks like, you see people walking out front, you get to know the neighborhood, you really start to understand the space as a living, breathing thing, not just as this box that you're going to put a restaurant in. And the more you understand that and the more you're there for that, to me, you have a better chance of really kind of getting the neighborhood and tweaking your concepts to really fit your neighborhood. So yeah, I love it.
Tell us a little, Bradford, I assume you've worked probably with different levels of budget.
Yes.
Tell us about the difference between working with, you know, a very bootstrapped tight budget space versus a very well-funded big corporate project.
Yeah, it's, you know, there is a difference obviously in the money you're spending. I think that the attitude, you know, whether you're spending $3 million or $150,000 and, you know, your relative is a construction manager, your approach is kind of the same. You really have to, first of all, be positive and resilient, because no matter what you're spending, you're probably going to at some point be at risk of going over budget. And it's really how you approach the decision making. When you start to go over budget, you know, where do you decide to trim and how do you decide to trim? And I always advise people that, you know, the two things that get overlooked, like the two first things that get cut from budgets are often lighting and music in a sit down restaurant. And those are the two things that you don't notice so much when they're really done well, and you notice when they're cheap. So those two things I always advise people not to cut if they can help it. And then when it comes to equipment, you can save money, you know, doing auctions or going on eBay and finding pieces. But I always advise for that, like, just understand that revenue producing pieces of equipment are probably not where you want to try and chance. Like, you know, if you can save on some stainless steel tables and hand sinks and smallware is great. Go for it. But if you really want to buy a used, you know, six burner double oven, it's going to be the mainstay on your line. That's probably not the smartest idea, because at some point it's going to break because it's somebody else.
You run the risk of repairs, right?
Right. Yeah. And then it's not even the repairs. It's revenue producing. Like a hand sink's not producing revenue. And if it breaks, you'll fail an inspection. If they come in, you can find a way around it for a day or two. But, you know, if your stove breaks, you're screwed on a Saturday. So,
You talked about going over budget. How many places have you seen stay on budget or under budget?
The thing about budgets is they change.
It sounds so like that a roundabout answer already.
That
Bradford.
Was a donut.
Is that evasive enough for you? No, I mean, like, we had a I worked at a kosher restaurant several years ago, like a really fine dining kosher restaurant that turned out to be a lot of fun and really interesting project. And they went in with a budget and it went over, but like towards the end of construction, it was, you know, there was some landmark issues with the building and a couple of mistakes in construction, and it was on the verge of going over. And, you know, they got another investor and they kind of adjusted the budget. So yeah, it went over the initial, but they were able to cover it with an investor and it got open. And, you know, it was an interesting place, and it ended up, the construction was great. The design was great. So, you know, the other one of my favorite ones is the Gumbo Bros in Brooklyn. You know, he did most of it himself. He had people that he worked with, and he opened under budget and, you know, opened on time and opened successfully. He just opened his second place in Nashville. So he was an example of, like, no one was going to get him to overspend. He knew construction. He got his equipment, most of it secondhand. He made it work. He was very resourceful and very determined, and they got open under budget and on time. They kind of muscled their way through it. And, you know, he just opened a second one that was much bigger and bigger budget and all that, but he still, you know, had that mentality. And it was actually kind of cool to see him sort of challenge me as I was advising him and really succeed and really, like, show that it can be done. You know, if you're smart and you've got some resources, it can be done.
For the budgeting piece, like, where do you see people? Is there one specific item in construction that people go over time and time again? Or is it just depending on, you know, the space and you know, where they are? Is there, like, something, you know, when you're looking at budgets in the beginning, you're like, try to pad this or, you know, move stuff around here?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it's tough. I think that equipment, we're usually able to, you know, I'll usually give a bigger number than what they need, so that it can, there's room to kind of work it down. You know, I think people don't always allow for contingencies with construction. They, you know, once they get a budget and a timeline, you know, that's why it's important. You've got to be there every week, every 2 weeks at the minimum, to sort of see the pace of construction and see how they're working and hear what things are coming up. Because everything in a vacuum is really not a big deal during construction. But the way that things can affect the next step of the progress, it can become a big deal. There was one place we built, and the Coca-Cola guy came, and, you know, we were debating, do we do bottle service or do we do the guns? And I'm always a proponent of not doing guns. I think they're filthy. And, you know, for an upscale bar, I just think bottle service looks better. It's easier to control. You know, but then there's more trash and there's more storage area, et cetera. But those guns with the fruit flies and the staff just drains them. Mm. I'm just always kind of advising not to use them. So, but they decided.
Make me think differently about fountain soda. Yeah, sorry.
Listen, there's a lot of things. Like, there's worse things than fountain soda, but fountains maybe not as much as the guns. But I said, okay, it's fine. I get it. You want to do the guns, no problem. So we got the Coca-Cola guy in. He did his measurements. He said, I'll see you, you know, 3 days before opening. I'll come and do the installation, put the rack in, et cetera. So the message was conveyed to the construction team. You know, here's where they're going. We need a hole cut here. They're going to run their tubes up through the hole. It was a basement up to a second floor. And nobody double checked, you know, the size of the chase that the tubes had to go in. And it didn't seem like a big deal. And it kind of, everyone forgot about it. So 2 days before opening, this beautiful Italian marble had been laid behind the bar. Behind the bar around to the front. It had all just been set. They were ready to do the installation. The guy shows up. The hole is 2 inches too small. So,
oh.
You know what happened?
Back to bottles.
The owner was like, no, I paid for Coke. You couldn't get out of the Coca-Cola contract. It was a shouting match on the construction site between the GC, the soda guy, the owner. And it turned out they had to cut the tile. They had to cut the tile. They had to order two new pieces to reset once the hole was recut. And it was a 3-day delay for chintzy soda guns.
To put some code in.
Wow, that was.
So you still don't like soda guns?
No, so not especially you don't like them.
Yeah, it was awful. Like a hard no on the soda gun. Yeah.
But if you think about
what a horrible thing to get delayed.
A 2-inch measurement, you know, on site that someone didn't double check, and it cost the owner 2 days of potentially, you know, doing his pre-opening. So that, those type of things, you know, like I said, that's not a big deal. in the scope of things. But then when it comes to how it affected the Marvel guy and the plumber and everything else, it became a big deal. So, yeah, details.
Details are important.
Details matter. Yeah.
Bradford, do you, so as far as your business is concerned, do you do different levels? Sorry, I can't get my question out. Do you get different levels of commitment, or will you review someone's business plan and give them advice on getting going? Or are you, you know, you're along for the ride for the whole shebang or nothing?
Yeah, no, I do all different levels. Some people just want menu and recipe work. I in case you can't tell, I kind of like to talk, and I'm really interested in the whole process. So like, if you want me to come and work on your menu, like I'm going to notice health department stuff and why did you put this fridge here? And like, I'm going to share that information because I just think it, you know, we can all help each other with our experiences, be better operators. But yeah, I do different levels. Right. I used to actually teach at ICC, the French Culinary Institute. I was part of a food business class, and there was about 8 of us that taught it for the last 6-7 years until the school closed. And so I had access to some really smart people from HR and business plans and all that. So we'd all kind of share clients or, you know, people that needed help and look at kitchen drawings or look at menus and help people with that. So yeah, all of it is interesting to me in different ways. And I do all levels of that.
How many consulting clients do you take on at a time? Are you like working on multiple openings right now? Or are you just with one client dedicated?
Usually 2 or 3 at a time. They never line up the way they look. They're going to line up on, you know, when you put Gantt charts together and like, oh, I got a client here and they'll open and then I'll start this one. They never line up. I can guarantee you that like 2 inspections at 2 different places will be on the same day, or 2 openings that were 3 months apart are going to end up somehow in the same week. But yeah, I usually 2 or 3. Right now I'm working with Patroon Restaurant and working on primarily menu stuff and getting them reopened and doing some seasonal specials, and which has been really a lot of fun. And it's a great restaurant that's been there for a long time. And then there's a couple seasonal places that I work with in the summer. And then there's a couple that are under construction right now that should open this summer. So it's kind of, you know, varying levels at each one. Some I'm in the kitchen with my Tillet apron cooking away, and some I'm, you know, just on site, just talking to construction teams and looking at placements and making sure that they get open properly. And then the seasonal one is just more kind of training the staff for the summer and getting them reopened and getting their inventories up. So yeah, it's always different parts of my brain, and that's what I love about it.
Tell us a little bit, Bradford, about the ones you're working on now. I think you mentioned to me about an all electric pizza restaurant.
Yes. So, downtown Brooklyn, it's going to be called Pizza 63 on Lafayette Avenue in Brooklyn. So the owners have the building, and there was no hood and no gas, and they want to do all electric. And you know, there's the thing with technology now, there's so much good equipment that you can do an all electric kitchen and really get good product. So these electric pizza ovens, you know, they burn about 600 degrees. And we're able to get a really nice crust. And I have a baker friend that I work with who really understands dough, and he's got a source for flour that's milled upstate. So we're able to get a really interesting crust in an electric oven. And we're going to do tap cocktails.
I've heard different things on venting and electric kitchens. Can you do an electric kitchen and skate by the venting rules, or do you still need venting in place?
Well, you need to vent, but you don't need a type 1 fire rated hood. So the expense of venting comes when you've got to put the black iron in. So when you have grease producing, you know, when you're roasting meats or you're cooking with gas and you're grease producing and there's a risk of a flame, and you need a type 1 hood. So you need the hood, the fire suppression, and then the black iron that lines the vent out the building. That's where it gets really expensive. So we're able to do with these ovens direct venting just to remove the heat, but we don't have to do the full black iron. And you know, that
do you still have to go to the top of the building, or can you just go out the side?
Well, fortunately, it's a shorter building. This can just go out the side because it's just heat.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if you were in a brownstone, would you have to go to the top?
Probably in a brownstone, yes. But okay. You know,
Alex
black iron.
Really trying to build.
It's
often a question that young entrepreneurs with a lower budget will ask: is if can I pull this off with an electric kitchen, and will that get me around, you know, the exorbitant cost of venting and Ansel systems and stuff that go in?
Yeah, and I'm seeing, I live in Harlem, and I'm seeing little things pop up in the ground floor of brownstone, mostly coffee shops. But you know, they'll have an induction, a panini press, a circulator. And you can actually, you can put a nice menu together. One of the projects I worked on was Taco Dumbo. And the first one was in Dumbo in Brooklyn. And we did all electric, not even vented. It was like a white box. And we didn't even have to do venting. We had a self-vented rotisserie. It was crazy. It would cook about it was like 9 chickens at a time, I think it cooked. And it was a little rotating rotisserie with a little self venting a box that basically a little scrubber that sat on top of it to clean the air. So we didn't, you know, the place smelled like chicken, but that's not a bad thing.
No, it's like grandma's house. I love it.
Yeah. And then we had steam table, and we had a griddle, and we had a CVAP cook and hold oven. So, you know, we cooked brisket, we cooked chickens, we rendered the chicken skin and put the gribbiness in the guacamole. Like, we could do everything, and it, the place was built in 3 months, you know, without inspections. And it was crazy. It was like, it couldn't process how quickly it happened because we didn't have to deal with the hood. So, and the gas inspection and all that other stuff. So yeah, it was kind of cool.
What's the typical timeline for you that you're seeing these days? Is like, I mean, 3 months is obviously extremely fast, but, you know, on average, what are you seeing in New York right now?
It's still, you know, 9 months is like the safe bet from signing the lease to getting open. You know, oddly, the supply chain, like the effect of COVID, it's just so funny how everyone's like, hurry up and get back. You know, which there is no getting back. Where this is a new frontier we're living in, and rightfully so, I think it's a good thing. But the fact that, you know, I'm talking to people not in the industry, like, oh, I can't wait to get back to restaurants, and I had to wait an hour for brunch, and I'm like, there's this staffing issue right now that's going on is not going to change like when unemployment ends. This is people kind of rethinking where they belong in the industry and how it affects their life. But all the other ancillary industries, like the drivers for the vendors, you know, one of the companies I order from, they're short 40 drivers. So there's no second deliveries in Manhattan right now for this company, which is, you know, if you mess up or you're really busy and you need a second delivery, this company, it doesn't exist anymore. And I'm seeing with construction, you know, like the lead time to get a walk-in built, it's going up every time I talk to somebody. It's, you know, it was 8 to 10 weeks. Now it's 12. Now everybody's getting busy reopening. You know, it's harder to get service techs. It's harder to get things custom built because there's just not a lot of laborers in all these industries. So, you know, 9 months is still a safe bet, but you've really got to be planning well and ordering ahead of time and, you know, staying ahead of any potential issues because, you know, mistakes now, you get put to the back of the queue, and it could be, you know, 9 months could turn into a year easily.
Yeah, we understand supply chain issues.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that's right.
For sure. I think the other challenge is that I think the customer sentiment has lost a little bit of its patience now that we're sort of all going back.
Yes.
I don't think that's rightfully should be the case. I think we all still need to remain, you know,
be
super
patient,
appreciative and patient and respectful and understand that you can't just flip the lights back on and run back in and everything will be like it was. We're also, we have to have, you know, a very reduced number of restaurants available. A lot of restaurants have closed and gone, which puts a lot of pressure on everyone else to sort of shoulder that impact and try and, you know, provide meals and the level of service that, you know, we were all accustomed to before pre-pandemic.
I know, I'd love to hear you guys say that. And obviously we are all very connected in the industry and very sensitive to it. I just hope that people, you know, a year ago, everybody, you know, were dying to go to their favorite restaurant and support the industry and post things on Instagram. You know, I just hope that people can come to grips with the reality of what food costs, what it costs to get food on a plate, you know, what the labor, like what it looks like to be an employee in a restaurant, you know, to understand, you know, complain, oh, don't, you know, why are we raising the minimum wage? Like even when it's raised and even that wages are up now, it's still barely livable in New York. And, you know, at some point the customer is going to have to participate. You know, it always makes me laugh that people go to a grocery store and they see prices going up of groceries and they see gas going up and somehow don't think that that's going to translate to their restaurant that's reliant on gas and groceries and supplies, that the cost isn't going to get passed on, you know? So I just hope that people become more aware of that.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, this is something that people have been talking about for a while in the industry about how can we, you know, get rid of tipping and charge more. And it's been abandoned, but maybe this is the time where the shift really happens. Are there any other like cultural shifts you're seeing within the restaurants that you're currently opening that you feel like has been exacerbated or sped up maybe because of COVID? Like, are they already building for takeout and delivery and those kind of things? Is there any other real
changes I think, you're seeing? You know, the delivery thing, I'm still trying to get my head around the delivery thing because obviously, the quick shift was everyone went to delivery takeout. And then you started to see during the reopening, fine dining sort of started dropping it because they're not built for that. And it's not financially viable for a lot of them. But, you know, as a consumer, again, are we willing to pay so much to have food delivered? Like for the convenience, the 30%, the tip, the delivery fee, whatever it is, you know, are we going to continue to pay for that? Because we value convenience, and not all food should be delivered. You know, some stuff, you know, the idea of a restaurant is to go and interact with people and experience the ambiance and everything. And I saw a lot of people trying to figure out how to deliver the hospitality aspect along with the food. And some did it well, and some did packaging better than others. But, you know, if delivery does continue, I think there's certain models that work better for it. I don't think everybody should look at, well, it's the future. I've got to build a delivery arm because not all food delivers well. And I think that you've got to decide, you know, from your menu or from your concept, does it make sense to deliver it in the first place? And then if it does, what's the most effective way and what's the most, I guess, the way where I can get it, where there's a perceived value. I don't feel like I'm being raped on the charges from the third party delivery. And the guest doesn't feel like the $9 hamburger costs $20 to have delivered. You know, there's gotta be somewhere in between where we can make it fair and reasonable.
Yeah. I'm all in on restaurants and like ready to sit down, have the hospitality, have the experience, have the service. And I'm with you that people like the guests need to understand that they're just going to have to start paying more. Tell us, last question before we move on to like our little lightning round. When people are considering hiring a chef consultant like yourself, what should they know before going into and starting and engaging one of these conversations?
Yeah, that's great. I, you know, I've been working on that. I don't have a great document yet, but I've been working on that. You know, before you sit down, I think you should really know your budget, or at least where your budget's going and understand where bringing a consultant in fits into that. You should really be comfortable with your concept. And to me, the first thing I should say is like being comfortable with your vision or your concept and being able to tell me in a sentence or two what it is, you know, why you're opening a restaurant. And I think that if you can do that clearly, then you can navigate the things that are going to come along the way, as long as you can return to your vision. If you have a foggy vision and things get difficult, you know, I said earlier, you can get dissuaded by people around you or opinions of people that taste things or things you read. So really understanding what you're trying to open is the most important, understanding your budget. And then when you do talk to a consultant, you know, treat it like an interview and have a couple meetings and understand, does this person have, you know, the personality to deal with the things that are going to come up and help me navigate what I don't know? Is this a person that I'm willing to spend time with to kind of work through this? Because it's kind of like bringing a partner on for a part of time. That it's someone you're going to bounce all your ideas off of. You're going to navigate difficult situations with. So it's got to be someone you're comfortable being around and sort of trusting their perspective. And then, you know, the cooking part probably isn't the most important, because you're going to hire a chef at some point, but having someone that's an experienced enough chef that can understand different types of food and can help you with that relationship with bringing a chef on board. Because that's also, you know, that handoff is super important as well. So those are the things.
Yeah, that's super helpful.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting that you said the cooking part's not the, like, it's like you're a chef, but the cooking part's not the most important part, because it's sure, it's like you're building the bones for the infrastructure, which
the sad reality,
it sounds like are important to know.
The reality that I've come to is that, you know, after all these years of cooking and being in chef-centric restaurants, you know, chef owners, that, you know, people return to restaurants. They want good food, but they return to restaurants for the way they feel. And usually the food isn't always the primary driving force. And that's a hard thing to swallow as a chef, but you're a big part of it. But I think it's really important that, you know, people return because of the way a place makes them feel, or, you know, the emotions that it inspires while they're there. And the food is, it can be and is a part of that, but it's not just the food.
That is a sad thing to swallow for Alex. Like, I see all the wheels turning in Alex's former chef brain.
I'm sitting here like, trying to think
don't you agree,
the best
Alex?
Way to say it, but it's, I agree 100%. I mean, my thought is that you're always replaceable.
Yeah.
And I know that's not the best way of saying it, but even the best chef, there's always going to be someone in 2 years that's better than you.
Right.
Well, if you and do so, like, mentorship, right, that should be the way.
This idea
it is,
that
right?
No one can do this but you, that end of it is just not, you know, unfortunately, that's for almost everyone, that's just not accurate. And someone else, and having the bones and the efficiencies and those things that you talked about, those are going to be more lasting. And
yeah, that'll be a sustainable
business. As is the culture
business.
Of the place and how you make the guests feel, I think.
But that's also very liberating.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you're right.
To understand, like, for you to say that and to understand that, and you cooked for a long time as well. Like, once you kind of come to terms with that, then you're sort of free to cook really how you feel. You're not like trying to cook 100%. Someone else's food. You're not trying to put on airs or stay up with the trends. You're just, you know, like, I don't know, like someone like Jonathan Waxman is so comfortable in who he is, and his food is so good and it's so authentic to who he is. It's not, you know, it's not trying to be anything other than what he does well. And, you know, there's many chefs like that. I don't mean to just pick it, but he's just someone that I think of like as being comfortable in their own body and who they are and who they are as a chef. And I think once you reach that point, that's when people really resonate, you know, when you're not cooking for the press or you're not cooking for an Instagram follow or whatever it is. It's just you're cooking food that means something very special to you. And it's coming from a place inside that only you have.
All right, cook what you want. It will set you free. That was a great takeaway. I love it. Cool. Let's go. Okay, last quick question.
Yeah. So
where does one look for like chef consultants like you? It's like, it doesn't seem like there's like a Google database just ready to happen. It seems like a lot of your clients are referrals, but maybe people in other cities. Where do people get in touch with people like you?
My add-on to that is, you don't tell us what your fee is, but what can we expect to pay? Is it always cash up front, or is there ever an investment partnership that happens with a consultant?
Yes to all that. I typically, I try and look at things on a project basis. I don't like charging by the hour because I feel like it you're cheating yourself because you're watching the clock as an owner, or it's a difficult way to work for me. I like to do a project. I like to, you know, sit down and figure out how much time and effort and resources I'm going to put into a project and give myself the timeline and say, here's the project fee for this amount of time. And, you know, with a window, if we go over X amount, it's fine. And if we go over that, then there's an extra fee. And it really sets everyone to just start working. And we're working for a timeline and we're working together. The smaller projects, you know, recipe testing or things like that, then it's like hourly or daily rates. And then equity is something that, you know, I've talked about with several clients over the years. Some worked out, some didn't. So to me, it's always like go into it as a project base. And then 9 months in, you have a really good idea if you can kind of work with this person going forward as a partner, or, you know, trust them to have equity. If you've earned your way in or you want to buy in, you know someone well if you've gone through 9 months opening a restaurant together. You've seen the good and the bad, and it's a great test. And it's like, you know what? Let's be partners. Or this was great, but I don't think we should work together. So, yeah, it really – there's no set answer. And then as to where to find them, you know, all my work I've been fortunate has been word of mouth. And I think – you know, you start in the industry, if you're looking for a consultant, is you reach out to people that have either opened restaurants or worked on building restaurants and ask if they know anyone. And then, you know, chefs that are between jobs or chefs that are, you know, have free time to do something on the side, you know, you're not going to pay them full time. You just say, you know, I need X amount of hours. I want you to look at these drawings and walk the site with me and advise me as to how you would build this and kind of start that way. But yeah, we need to put a resource together for people, I think.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful. See, it's like you have to know to know.
Yeah.
Y'all, it's been a long pandemic. I'm ready to saddle up next to the bar, which is finally allowed to happen here in New York City. And thankfully, there are free tools to get your team ready.
Yeah, Diageo Bar Academy has a free online resource for hospitality professionals that offers lots of resources, not only for bartenders, but for the bar managers, the venue owners, and everybody that's involved to get that process up and running.
Yeah, and did Alex mention that they are free tools and all you need to do is sign up for Diageo Bar Academy?
And if you'll notice, you'll notice that a lot of times you get into it and there's a lot more than just drinks behind the bar, right? It seems obvious, I guess, but Diageo will sort of point out some of those things that you're missing and help you deal with them. And those are things like costing out your menu, and that goes from everything from the juices to the straws to the paper napkins that sit on top of the bar.
Right. So get your free profitability calculator at DiageoBarAcademy.com. That's DIAGEO BarAcademy.com. Become a member and sign up for the newsletter today. It's completely free and you will be amazed at all they have to offer.
That's DIAGEO BarAcademy.com.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based customers into your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat. And it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also frozen, pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres called Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, "So good, I feel guilty eating it." Put the fastest growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn.
All right, let's go to a quick lightning round. This is meant to be just like quick 1 to 2 word answers off the top of your head.
Okay.
I'll start. Don't worry, it's not a test. It's not like multiple choice. Don't be scared. This is like Jeopardy. Don't worry, there's no big prize at the end. What's the best part about being a consultant?
I would say freedom, that I'm able to work when I like to work for the most part.
Mm-hmm. What's the hardest part?
The freedom and having to budget my time and be very smart with when I work and how I work.
Yes, I hear that.
Tell us your biggest win from an opening.
Biggest win from an opening. That is a really hard question. I would say opening night at Miss Lily's, to see how many people we crammed into a small space and how much food was able to be served out of a very, you know, a 10-foot line, very tiny kitchen. And it's food that's very personal to me. And so that was probably one of the bigger wins.
Oh, to be crammed into a small restaurant space. Yeah, again. Exactly. I actually am looking forward to that.
Just saying that made me feel kind of weird. Like, ooh, did we talk about that yet?
Ooh, yeah, that was like, you know, it was 10 years ago, people. It's okay.
Yeah.
No.
I can keep my 6 feet. Bradford, what's the biggest oh shit moment aside from the Coca-Cola pipe?
Biggest oh shit moment.
And that's not a reflection on Coca-Cola. I'm sure they're a wonderful company.
Yeah, I'm sure they're great people to deal with. I got to be honest with you. Every opening has had an oh shit moment. I don't know that I could pick one out. I got the Row Hotel, used to be the Milford Hotel. I basically opened the lobby food and beverage program a few years back, and was sort of acting food and beverage director. And one of the biggest oh shit moments was everybody paid cash, and the amount of times that I had to go to the bank the first 2 days to get change in Times Square. That was kind of oh shit. Like, what is going on here?
What is going on?
It's not the sexiest
remember
story.
Remember cash? But, like, that's another thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's true.
It was all cash. Too much cash. Everyone had stayed there. Yeah, it was so weird. Yeah.
That is so funny. All right, and this is one that we like to ask everybody, and last one, what's the best business resource? Can be a podcast or a book or a person that you've come across that people in the industry should know about?
Besides you guys, obviously, right?
Aww.
I gotta say Culinary Agents for staffing. I love what they've done with their site. They've become a real resource for managing people and finding talent. And my friend Jerry Cuveris at Samtel is probably the smartest kitchen person that I've ever encountered. And the kind of person that I can call. And if somebody wants a hot dog roller for a 7-Eleven, I can call him and he'll give me a breakdown on the technology and which company makes the best one. What's the best value for the dollar? How, you know, he'll tell me how big it is off the top of his. He's like, oh, it's 18 inches wide, so you need a stainless steel counter. But at a gas station, they're only 20 inches. Like, he'll rattle stuff off out of his head. He's like an encyclopedia for me. If I ever get stuck with kitchen equipment, he's my first call. So those are my two.
Good to know, kitchen equipment guy.
Yeah. You want to do some opening soon?
Yeah, we like to shout out opening soon announcements. Anybody you want to shout out for opening soon or maybe recently reopened?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you're in Midtown and you can get to Patroon, they've got a gorgeous rooftop and they've never done dining on the roof before. So for the rest of the summer, they'll be dining on the roof at Patroon. Incredible steaks, seafood, cocktails, and then keep an eye out for Pizza 63. in Brooklyn on Lafayette, probably midsummer.
Midsummer, cool. Jerk Candy, who Amanda was already on the show.
I loved her earlier on your show, by the way.
Yeah, that was a good one. So if you haven't listened to episode 72 with Amanda, definitely go back and listen. It was really important.
All about the restaurant relief fund.
It was about the restaurant relief fund and about, you know, a lot about the wages and what people are getting paid. But they're opening this Thursday, so congrats to them. And then Mace Cocktail Bar, who's from the team behind, they have a bunch of other bars too. They're opening on the 21st.
He's actually a friend
Katana
also.
Kitten, that team.
They have a couple.
Yeah, from Katana Kitten. And
yeah, and Zach's got a couple of coffee places uptown. Dear Mama Coffee.
Dear Mama. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yes, we're excited for that. Go ahead.
Half of New York is reopening on May 21st, so get ready to go out.
Get ready to eat.
Bradford, how do we find you on social, online?
BellyfulNYC on Instagram and LinkedIn, my name at LinkedIn, and then I'm working on building a new website right now, so hopefully that'll be up soon.
There you go, a resource for people looking for restaurant consultants.
There you go.
Real website.
And you can find us at We Are Opening Soon and at Till It NYC. Thanks, Bradford.
Thank you so much.
That Thank you awesome. Guys so much.
Opening Soon is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter, enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. And connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You could also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.